ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world can be a very dangerous place.
The compounds in Myanmar are run by criminal gangs.
American forces snatched Venezuela's president.
You hit us, we'll hit you back again and again.
But behind every conflict is a very interesting story. I'm Matt Bevan. And my show, If You're Listening, takes a look at global stories from the safety of my basement. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Japanese Prime Minister has touched down in Canberra for a 3-day visit as Australia and Japan look to strengthen their energy security and the economic partnership as well. Now, the meeting really matters. It comes as the Prime Minister rules out an increasingly popular and populist push for a gas profits tax in the budget. Meanwhile, the fallout from the death of a 5-year-old girl known as Kumanjai Little Baby is reverberating across the country. And while the opposition has called for an inquiry, as sorry business commences, Kumanjai Little Baby's family is calling for unity and time to grieve without all of the politics. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Jacob Grieber. So I hope you've got all your sort of cherry blossom lines ready for the Japanese visit, although there's none here in Canberra, I can tell you. It's all grey and it's all, you know, browns and greens falling off trees, basically. It's that time of year.
I'm glad you've gone a little weather because I just got a notification that the Prime Minister and the Japanese Prime Minister can't do an outdoor event because the weather's so bad. Is that right?
It's sort of rainy in and on and off today. I guess it wouldn't have looked great,
right?
With them sort of holding umbrellas over their heads, probably. So they had the, you know, the bang bang stuff out the front of Parliament with the cannons. They did that, and then they had to move the sort of meeting with all the school children waving Japanese and Australian flags. That was inside the entry area of Parliament House, where visitors all come in. So they did it there.
All right, instead. So they did it in the safe spot. So the Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi is in Canberra for a 3-day trip. That's really after, if you think about sort of the backdrop here, after Penny Wong's visit to Tokyo to meet with her Japanese counterpart to shore up energy security. This is all around the 50 years of the Nara Friendship Treaty between the two nations. So, you know, and this language is interesting too, isn't it? Where it's a friendship treaty. That's not quite... It's like a hybrid, isn't it? It's not quite an ally, but it's some sort of hybrid version. Jacob, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it is. And just to quickly go through the history of this, and as we're talking, the Prime Minister and the Japanese Prime Minister, they're actually in the cabinet room having a sort of meeting now where they're talking about some of these issues that we can get onto. But the history of it, after the war, there was a commercial agreement mm-hmm. signed in the 50s between Australia and Japan, and that really started the great iron ore boom. But that was really strictly business. There wasn't a lot of, you know, the war was still way too fresh and people weren't ready to forgive and forget. When Whitlam came in, he started a process of trying to bring the relationship more on a more friendly, culturally inclusive sort of setting, and they set up this thing that's now known as the Nara Treaty that was signed not by Whitlam but by Fraser exactly 50 years ago in June. And then, of course, there's been some other ones along the way. Tony Abbott and Abe had, of course, that trade deal that they signed. And really interesting, Patricia, the language from the Australian government, particularly the likes of Penny Wong and Richard Marles, they say no other country is more aligned with Australia strategically than Japan. Mm. That's some boilerplate they've been using really since sort of second half of last year you started to hear it, and it's really striking. So I think there is a sort of desire maybe to have an upgraded treaty. That's not going to happen, I don't think, this week. There's no sign of that. The Japanese are not ready for that kind of a step. But it is also clear, PK, and I've been sort of Googling Japanese media, they've been talking about the fact that this is the 50th anniversary for a while now. That's something that the Japanese are keen to emphasize.
interesting you say no upgrade yet, a sort of intensification, if you like. I mean, the fact that this is so early in the new Japanese Prime Minister's prime ministership and she's making the trip to Australia, I think, is significant. You talk about our strategic position and the language that's being used. This is key because China, of course, looms large in the background of all of this and in the meeting. And if you look at the Japanese Prime Minister's rhetoric and positioning, she's kind of a China hawk, right? Like,
yeah, and
this is key. And some people in our strategic circles, as in like in the Canberra bubble, it depends where you sit on this, but are sort of worried about a sort of intensification that may be, depends where you sit, as I say, that might be draw us in some way because that's her positioning in relation to China.
So, yeah, two quick things. One, there's a bit of frustration around the press gallery this morning. It's fair to say, PK, that she is not taking any questions. We've been told not to expect an opportunity to ask her any questions. She and our Prime Minister will simply give statements a little time later today. There's no ability to interrogate that statement. There's no ability to ask the kind of question you're alluding to around the defence posture vis-a-vis China and Taiwan, but also on the energy issue, the whole question around the taxation of gas that's been a big, big campaign in the last few weeks. The Japanese Prime Minister would have a very different view, and it's a little surprising that she won't take questions on that. Now, she might address those things in her statement. We'll have to wait and see. But to go back to your point, James Curran, in writing in the Financial Review last week, made that point quite forcefully that her hawkish rhetoric, and there's a little concern that she's overcooking some of that rhetoric, actually threatens to drag us into a conflict with China that's needless. Now, there's an active debate there. I think ASPE's pushed back against that this morning, saying that's wrong, that's not what's at stake here. But it's one of those tensions, and it's there. It's that one of those big elephants in the room behind the nice pomp and ceremony of the meeting. I mean, I don't know. Where do you sort of see that going? It's so interesting, the defence relationship with Japan and the closeness of it. And we're buying their frigates and we're, you know, I think there's going to be a critical minerals agreement today as well.
We love a critical minerals agreement, don't we? Sorry.
Can't have enough of them.
It's on the bingo. Like you just like bingo card, another critical minerals agreement. Come on. We love them. We're like, Everyone who steps up to our country, we're like, would you like to look at our critical minerals? You know, we've got some good ones. Sorry, cracks me up. Of course, I know that critical minerals are really key, but it's like the break glass agreement of any visitor. Am I right or am I right?
It is sort of the new, I don't know, if you haven't got an NRL deal to sign with the other country, you just whip out the old critical minerals package, you know. Hey, check them out.
Yeah. Look, I think it's not, I believe that we've had a few, if I can zoom right out, a few visits recently from key leaders. I'm thinking Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister. That was very key in terms of our relationship with the US and as in our middle power strategic reset, if you like. And, you know, that was key. Now we've got this one with the Japanese Prime Minister, pretty key when it comes to the geopolitics of our region and making sure we don't go too far. But I think the Australian government wants to certainly signal. Of course, this is being watched closely in China. Of course, we're going to keep our Japanese friends close. I just think it's Australia perhaps obviously putting out the red carpet for key friends, in the case of Canada, allies, you know what I mean? But also signalling where we stand in a changed world. Am I reading too much into it? I mean, that's
no,
how
I don't
I
think
see
so
these
at
visits.
All. I think, and you've also had Ursula von der Leyen, the EU boss. We also had the Chinese premier out here. That was a bit of a low-key visit, but he was here not that long ago. You've had German defence ministers, French ministers. There's a whole lot of alliance work going on. And the subtext, I think, is not even a subtext. It's what's the opposite of that? Yeah. The main
it's
text.
It's a vert. It's a vert.
Which is we are worried about the United States and what Donald Trump is doing to alliances. And this morning, you can see yet again the consequences of like-minded countries that criticize the United States. They get punished immediately. And I'm thinking here of Frederick Mertz, who said last week that the Americans have been humiliated by the Iranians. Donald Trump has responded by, I think, slapping some more tariffs on Germans and now wants to withdraw 5,000 troops from Germany, maybe even more. So that we're in that world. And so Donald Trump's sort of doing that globally to allies and otherwise friendly countries. In the meantime, the rest of the world is busy, busy, busy having these sorts of meetings, having these sorts of trips that we're seeing today. And it's not to say those trips aren't without tensions. They are. I think the energy one's really big for this one with Japan, but it's all about demonstrating a sort of unity among like-minded countries outside the direct US relationships. That's new, I think.
I think that is new. Look, we are now officially in just warning to politics now, listeners. We are in key fever pitch speculation week before the budget. Of course, we've been having kind of discussions about the budget for some time, but we're at that kind of peak time. This week is the orchestrated leaks, perhaps some good journalism too of finding out what might be in the budget. All of that's on for the next week till it's delivered. The Treasurer has flagged spending restraint in the budget. Okay, he's been saying that for a while, hasn't he? I mean, it's, you know, that's been known because tomorrow, of course, is interest rates day, a day of national sadness when they go up for people, unless, of course,
people with mortgages.
Yeah, right. That's exactly. Depends where you, right. where you sit on that one. But a lot of people have mortgages, so let's go with that.
A lot of people have mortgages. A lot of people won't be enjoying what's very likely, according to the markets, to happen tomorrow, yeah. Are they? And yeah. it's a tough thing to swallow, really, when it's a crisis. There was definitely an inflation problem before the war, but the war's going to make it worse. So why are households being hit? That will be the questions people ask themselves.
That's exactly right. And it's a reasonable question about the way that the blunt instrument that the RBA has to deal with inflation, but at a time where the economy is slowing down because of the Middle East war. This is the
thing. So why is the Treasurer so keen to cut spending, do you think, Patricia? Because I know he bristles at the idea that his budget is responsible for inflation, but there are others who take a different view.
Mm. Does he bristle but kind of privately concede? Like, you know, because why would you need to take an axe to your budget a little bit if that's, yeah, I mean, sorry, but you can't have it both ways, bristle and then also concede that you need to do it. I mean, I've said this before, I'm sorry, it's just like quite obvious that he knows that there's too much money in the economy or he wouldn't be doing that. How far they go is going to be the real test, I think. So the only thing we really know for sure is the NDIS. Then there's the sort of preparing us for a tough budget. And then there's a bit of speculation about things like the fuel excise, the cut to that, which of course was introduced to help us deal with high petrol prices during the war, whether that gets extended. It seems to me that the Treasurer is not a big fan of necessarily extending that, although he might be forced to if this continues, right, Jacob?
Well, yeah, and it's the problem for the Treasurer is this is a revenue stream that he's, you know, denying himself at a time when he's desperately searching for new revenue. And there's been endless speculation about whether they move on capital gains tax as a way to raise revenue. And I think he was setting some expectations around that, although that was this morning when he indicated at a press conference that that any tax raised would be a lot less than the savings they've made from the NDIS. Well, the NDIS, they're claiming $35 billion over 4 years. So, I mean, in a sense, it's not a very helpful statement. It doesn't really tell you how much tax they might be aiming for from any CGT change. And bear in mind, they keep telling us, you know, wait until budget day on that one. But he needs revenue. And so extending the fuel excise cut eats into his revenue base at a time which is not great for him. And so, yeah, the reluctance to continue it. I don't think they've ruled out continuing it, to be honest. I think that'll depend on the circumstances and whether this war continues, whether the blockade continues. That will be the reality, and because all of that will push prices up globally, and that's the reason we have that excise cut.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. Just on that, just one more kind of observation. Donald Trump's obviously announced his plan to support ships going through the Strait. Iran saying that would violate the ceasefire. So even any attempt to kind of get some movement through, whatever you make of Donald Trump's offer, it's been rebuffed. So it just shows, back to the fuel excise and our analysis, that this protracted war is never ending. So just caveat on that, like, this is going to continue.
You have to put a caveat over all of that, because it moves from one day to the next. There's the taco trade that keeps coming up. There's always the sort of bad news at the end of the trading week on Wall Street, and then lo and behold, some solution appears on the Sunday and the markets recover. There's a whole bit of that. I just wanted to also draw you, PK, to one thing the Prime Minister said on Friday. It was at a conference for Western Sydney. It's one of these events that is sponsored by the Daily Telegraph. The Prime Minister took a bunch of questions. He was asked about tax, and he made quite a striking statement, I thought. He said, and he was referring here to, I think, some of the CGT speculation. "I know there's been a bit of speculation, all of it wrong." That's quite a big thing to say, isn't it? Don't you think?
All of it wrong.
All of it wrong. When people see what we're actually going to do in the budget, people will be able to make their own assessments. I just think if you've said that clearly, I wonder what's wrong with the speculation.
All of it wrong.
All of it.
No, you know what? It's not all wrong. He just likes to say it's all wrong because he loves a bit of that. Come on. There's column A, column B.
We're going to hold him to account here, PK. We're going to
Some bits are probably a little off, but on the sort of right wavelength. So
Do you think it'll be in the nuance, you reckon?
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll and there'll be things we didn't expect, like, of course, the last budget where we didn't expect that tax cut. The opposition, to their detriment, I think, really, and their brand, said no to it under Peter Dutton. Now, that was, just to give you some context about budgets, not anticipated and was just a tiny, it wasn't a huge one, but a tax cut little nugget in the budget that no one expected, was not leaked, and then really, well, led to the opposition making a move that I think has done them some serious damage that they've been recovering from.
And they deeply regret to this day,
Now, I think it's really important that we address the rather depressing, horrid news that dominated the end of last week and over the weekend, and of course I think should continue to dominate, and that's the death of the 5-year-old Kumanjai little baby. 47-year-old Jefferson Lewis has been charged with murdering the 5-year-old girl. That's a week after she disappeared from the old-timers town camp near Alice Springs. I think some caveats here. The family has asked people to honour sorry business, which is underway. They are grieving the death of a child. It's pretty difficult for them to process, and I think they should be given respect to do that. Having said that, I do think there needs to be a big emphasis on safety of children, of Aboriginal children who are too often ignored, of the kind of conditions people have to live in, of the way that our correctional systems work. All of this must be on the table. Now, I do think context matters, when, how to have those conversations all matters, absolutely. But the federal government provides a lot of money to the Northern Territory, so we are entitled to ask questions about the standards at which children live in, and I think that even if you park the kind of level of gratuitous commentary, which I think should be parked, a broader look at the systemic failures must be had. You can't have a child die in these circumstances anywhere without asking some tough questions. Now, whether those tough questions should be asked in coming days or weeks or when at the appropriate time, That is definitely something that must be respected in terms of timing. Timing matters, but you cannot put this off forever. These are really important systemic questions that need to be asked.
Yeah, and it should be possible to do both. No,
you can respect the family's wishes for a little period, and then still have the conversations, right?
And you have to have the conversations because it looks like there is some structural issue here at play. You wouldn't accept these circumstances elsewhere. So let's have that debate. And I'm not at all qualified to comment on it. I'd want to hear from people who do understand the community and those issues and how the money gets spent. I think the very interesting thing is we've been in a sort of no-go zone on Indigenous issues and affairs really since The Voice, politically speaking, I'm saying. It's just one of those topics that's been parked. This is the first time I think that it's bringing it back to a mainstream debate, perhaps you could say, because this is such a tragic event. It's made people ask a bunch of questions, and that's not something we've seen the last few years. I think you'd agree, PK. So you've now got the opposition. You have Jacinta Namba-Jimba Price, who is familiar with that community, saying it's time to have an honest conversation about the state of affairs in town camps. And the opposition more generally, Matt Canavan on Insiders on the weekend, saying it was time for there to be a royal commission. I don't know the government's going to go anywhere near such a thing, but is there a way to do something along those lines, or does that all just become horribly politicised very quickly?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Royal Commission call and why some people in the Aboriginal community, I say some because some people do support it, right? Like anything. Of course, this is a diverse community. But the reason...
And this would be about looking at where the money goes, isn't it, ultimately?
Yeah. I mean, I don't just think this is a funding issue, of course, right? This is, although, you know, there are some pretty poor conditions in some of these town camps generally. And that is clearly a funding issue, but there's also broader issues going on too. That's why I say it's systemic. But, you know, the correctional questions that have to be asked. I mean, one of the Aboriginal elders who stood up after the riot outside the Alice Springs Hospital, you know, saying that there were consequences to that kind of behaviour and most of the community doesn't support it. That was broadly what these men were saying. But one of them was saying, if you get released from prison, there is nowhere for you to go. So if you are a prisoner and you've been incarcerated for a long time, then you will go back to the town camp where you know people, right? Like, where is the systemic support to ensure that that person is not in that environment? That is one question I can tell you right now that needs to be answered. That is a clear question that will need to be answered. And there's too much, yes, politicisation of, you know, you either do this or you do that. The truth is, with Indigenous Affairs, what I found as someone who covered it but is not Aboriginal is that actually the truth is in all of the grey, in all of the nuanced, yes, some things have to be tried, but this kind of, we're just going to do this radical approach. No, that is not what works straight away. You have to work with communities. It takes years of investment. There's so much nuance, but of course in the crude politics of the day-to-day, it's a kind of blame game. It's ugly. And that's why the community, by the way, is asking for this not to be discussed in those terms, because that's how it becomes. It becomes a culture war, and they don't want it to be a culture war because they're grieving this little girl. Okay, this is difficult to talk about, but we're going to have to talk about it again because it's actually incumbent on us as a nation to talk about it again and not to just keep going, I think Matt Canavan is right. You know,
all too hard.
Referendum went down. Yes, we talk about that. Oh, that is not the way a smart country resolves historical wrongs and deals with the contemporary manifestations of those wrongs, which is what I think a lot of the problems we see are. Look, before we say goodbye on this pod, I want to just briefly talk about the Farah by-election, which is this weekend. I'll be part of the coverage on ABC TV on the news channel on Saturday night. I'm really excited about it because it is genuinely a really exciting by-election. As daggy as that sounds, it's true. That's why you listen to this podcast, that people like me get excited
it's
about it.
It's not daggy for our listeners,
nah,
PK.
It's not actually right. This is the right people to say that to. So One Nation candidate David Farley, Independent Michelle Millthorpe, they're the key contenders, and there is the story. The fact that I've just called them the key contenders is the yarn. Because it's a Liberal Party seat and has always been a coalition seat, and they're the main contenders. Matt Canavan tried to downplay concern the coalition could lose such a significant seat. He said, these things don't concern me. I'm worried about our country. Bit of bluster, really. I mean, they're trying to just manage the optics of this, aren't they, Jacob?
Yeah, look, and I think they acknowledge that they're on the nose in that electorate. They're fighting an uphill battle. I think they're probably taking a longer-term strategy to it, which is, yeah, they'll lose it, but they've got an eye on how they might regain that seat maybe at the next election if they were to lose it on Saturday. I've heard people sort of offer different theories about that's why they're actually preferencing One Nation, because they feel, notwithstanding that it would be the first One Nation clear win in the lower house ever, that they could then win that seat back more easily than if the independent won it. Interesting tactical question. We'll have to wait and see on that one. It is actually a fun by-election. It's throwing up all sorts of good headlines for journalists. There was a comment from Farley last week at a candidates forum that was hosted by Barry Cassidy, former ABC big name. And Farley said, look, Labor's immigration numbers are about right, which is definitely not to One Nation script. So there's been a bit of clean-up there by Barnaby Joyce over the weekend. And yes, clean Matt up. Canavan says he's very committed to winning. He is desperate to demonstrate that he's literally getting dirty down in the dirt, and he is. He's been living in a swag for days on end, apparently, according to his Instagram feed. So he's got a very fetching flannel top on every morning, and he looks the part, is all I can say. I think he might even be enjoying it.
Oh, yeah, I think he likes actually campaigning. I've seen him campaign because I worked on that Four Corners where I saw him sort of talking to people in Queensland. I think he actually does like it, which is why he also, I don't know if people recall this in that story, but he left open the door of running in the lower house. I think he does.
Yeah, interesting. So interesting.
Yeah, because he does like a bit of the, on the ground stuff as well.
Well, okay, the leader of the National Party is usually from the lower house, so that's a little bit of a structural issue there.
But they got their heads around it, didn't they? They did. They went, yeah, let's do it.
Just on by-elections, there was the state, Victorian state by-election of Nepean, which I think that was seen as a perhaps pre-Farah test of One Nation's strength and momentum. They didn't make it. The Liberal held on, I think, which will be good news for the Liberal Party. But PK, is that too simplistic? Would they have liked to have won that even more emphatically, or are they concerned down there? Is there now reason for them to be worried as they look at the state election and taking on Labor that their vote gets split?
They should be very concerned. Look, the Nepean by-election, right, in Victoria, yeah, they won. Just like, you know what I mean? Like they've had a backlash to them. This is at a time when the Allan Labor government is old, disliked. It should be shooting fish in a barrel in a seat like this. Now there's fish and they can't shoot them. They've literally won, but it's hardly a victory. Like, as in what I mean by that is a victory is a victory. Don't take, it's in their column. I'm not sort of rewriting the result. But Jacob, it's not an emphatic win, and if you're getting a backlash against you in this climate, that's not helpful, is it? I mean, I think Jess Wilson, the Victorian Liberal leader, gave all of the right comments about learning lessons from this. She's, really trying to recast the Liberal Party. They haven't given her a whole lot to work with, though, if you look at their shenanigans over the period. So even that they were having this by-election.
And then in that by-election, I think there's 80% of the votes been counted so far. One Nation got almost a quarter of the primary vote. So that really tells you that the national polls that we've been seeing about One Nation are probably very much on the money.
Yeah, I think very much on the money. Well, that's it for Politics Now today. Thanks for joining me, Jacob.
My pleasure.
And the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion is holding its first public hearings today. Raph Epstein and I will dig into that tomorrow when we've given it a bit more time to settle and for some of the people to address the Royal Commission today. Then, of course, we've got the RBA rates decision tomorrow too. If you have a question for us, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. We will endeavour to answer it in our special question episode coming up. Jacob, see ya.
Catch ya.